The Buddha's teaching is sometimes called the path of purification. One of the most elaborate explanations of the teaching is the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification. And I have given a title to our workshop today and tomorrow, the path of purification, because that is actually what happens when we meditate. And we will have a look and see how does it happen. And we will see also how important it is that it does happen. We don't purify for others, but they also have a lot of benefit from that. But we purify for our own benefit. And whatever happens within us is always transmitted to those around us. So whatever is happening in our lives, with our families, at our work, it all changes very slowly and almost imperceptibly, but always towards purity. The path of purification, as we experience it in meditation, is a very definite one. And obviously it can only happen if we meditate regularly, again and again. Because obviously there is impurity happening in our minds, so that we need to counteract that again. The first thing that purifies in meditation is the fact that concentration, which I mentioned last night already, is purification. The moment we concentrate, that moment is one of purity. Nothing impure can happen in our minds. We have two aspects of ourselves. In Pali, in the Buddha's language, they're both under the same heading of citta. But for in our English language, it's much simpler if we divide them into heart and mind. The thought process and the emotions. So today, we'll talk about our thought processes. And tomorrow, we'll talk about the emotions and how this can be purified through the meditation and also, of course, through our understanding what we do in our daily lives. Now, when we concentrate, which means we are actually one-pointed on the meditation subject, that moment is a moment of purity. The more we collect moments of purity, add one on to the next, the more of it there will be within us. So that a long-time meditator could be expected, and I say could be expected, to have accumulated a fair bit of purity. If, and there's a big if behind that, if that person has also taken the work into daily life, and the work is substituting with the opposite. Now that's a phrase which the Buddha used, and I'll explain it to you. It's what we have to do in meditation. Now most of you, or maybe all of you, have already done some meditation and have already experienced what the mind does instead of meditating. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. It thinks, and it has all sorts of fantasies and plans and hopes, remembrances, and then it gets disgusted, and all sorts of ideas it gets. And then, of course, it does go back to the breath eventually, and then it starts all over again. That's human nature. That's the way it is. So when we have a thought in meditation, we substitute with attention on the breath. At that particular moment, that is the opposite of thinking. The breath being our meditation subject to start out with, we use that as our substitute. Now, that is something that we need to take into daily life, and only then will it bear the kind of fruit which we can name purification. In meditation, what I'd like you to do is, when we start and we put the mind on the breath, and I'll say in a moment the different ways one can do that, when a distracting thought arises, to give it a label. The labeling process is one which helps us to take that into daily life with us. Now, a label would be future, past, unnecessary, later, worry, planning, hoping, disliking, rejecting, boredom, any of those or any other. The first label that comes to mind is the right one. It's no use trying to find a better one, because all we do then is have a new thought process. Where do I find a better label? Maybe this one's not so good. First label is good. This labeling enables us to learn a lot about our own mind. First of all, we learn that the moment we become the observer, by labeling we're the observer, we're no longer the thinker. And the thought disappears. Of course, something else will rearise after a while. There's no saying that this is now a permanent dissolution, but at least by being an observer, we can get to know ourselves. In fact, this is the fourth foundation of mindfulness: content of thought. So when we label, we have that as the first benefit. When we see ourselves as the observer, we no longer have to think. We can go back to the breath. The second thing is that we get a very good idea of our habitual thinking pattern, because we will find that we will be using the same or similar labels over and over again. Some people are constantly planning what they're going to do tomorrow, what they're going to cook tomorrow. Some people are constantly remembering what they should have said yesterday when they had a chance. Some people are constantly worrying. The meditation isn't so good. Is it ever going to get better? So we label, and by that label, we get to know ourselves a little better. There is a pattern to our thinking. And as we see that pattern, there's something we can do about it. We can break through the pattern. We can let go of this habit. Not immediately, but through diligence and continuation of the effort. Perseverance and diligent effort are absolutely essential. Without that, there won't be any result. So that's the second benefit. We get to know our thinking pattern. And the third benefit has to be done in daily life. As we learn to label our thinking, we will do it habitually in our daily living eventually, and we will be able to substitute the wholesome for the unwholesome. Now that's called the four supreme efforts. And they are four of the 37 factors of enlightenment. And they make all the difference in one's daily living. If you take nothing else home with you from this weekend workshop, other than the four supreme efforts, and actually try to practice them, you will have made a great step forward on the spiritual path. The four supreme efforts are voiced and worded by the Buddha in this way: not to let an unwholesome thought arise which has not yet arisen. Not to let an unwholesome thought continue which has already arisen. To make a wholesome thought arise which has not yet arisen. To make a wholesome thought continue which has already arisen. In other words, as we learn in meditation to label the distracting thoughts, this will then be an opportunity to continue labeling our thinking in our daily lives and be able to tell when there is an unwholesome thought. Everybody knows the difference between wholesome and unwholesome. It's our conscience and our inner feeling which tells us. We often justify our unwholesome thoughts, but that doesn't make them any less unwholesome. That just adds justification, that's all. And justification is not purification. Purification means substituting with the opposite. Whenever there is an unwholesome thought, it is one of either wanting or disliking, rejecting. And the way we can tell that we have it, there's an inner feeling of disquiet. It isn't conducive to peacefulness. Wholesome thoughts, helpful, loving, caring, are those that we can continue. And if they haven't arisen yet, we should make them arise. Now, obviously, we need a fair bit of mind strength to do this. Because most people whose meditation practice has not yet become very strong are subject to their thinking processes. They believe everything that happens in their thoughts. And this is another benefit we get from the labeling. We can see that most of the stuff that arises in meditation is totally unbelievable. We don't need it. A lot of it is fantasy. A lot of it is dreams that we make up for future. And a lot of it is just sort of fragmentary. It's not something which is important to us. And as we see that through the labeling process, we can take that into daily life, that we don't believe every thought that we have, and therefore we don't have to act upon every thought that we have. And therefore, if we have a thought that says, this person is ugly, this person is awful, we don't have to believe that. We know it's just a negative thought. It seems simple. The only way to find out is to do it. we have for so long believed everything that we've been thinking and acted upon it, that it isn't quite that easy as it sounds to no longer believe it and to know that it's just opinion. But as we practice in meditation the labeling, we will be able to do that much easier in our daily living. And then we will see that many of our thoughts are not only just opinion, but they're totally unnecessary. We don't need them. We expend a lot of energy, an awful lot of energy, on thinking. Anyone who's here, who has an office job, and comes home at night dead tired, will be able to identify with the fact that nothing physical has happened, but the mind has been going all day, and one is dead tired. One has been pushing a pencil or a pen around physically, but mentally one's been pushing a lot of people around, and that's very tiring. So if we can conserve our energy from the unnecessary thinking, from the unwholesome thinking, and thereby gain far more mind strength, both will be benefiting our meditation and our daily lives. The quality of our lives depends upon the quality of our mind. Meditation is the only way that we can improve the quality of our mind, because the quality of our mind does not depend on knowing. The quality of our mind depends on being. So this is the way to improve that quality. And the strength of mind comes about when we are able to put the mind where we want to put it. When we become able to put the mind where we want to put it, we'd obviously never again be unhappy. Nobody becomes unhappy voluntarily. It's our thinking that makes it so. So that are briefly benefits of the meditative practice, which obviously need to be taken into daily life in order to really flourish, and also in order to make it possible to meditate properly. Because we cannot expect our mind to be meditative when we sit down with our legs crossed and be totally unmeditative all day long. Let it think what it wishes to think. React to every thought we have. Don't care about what goes on in our mind, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, and then sit down with the legs crossed and hope that we're going to be concentrated and experience bliss. Doesn't make sense, does it? We've got one mind, not two, one for daily life and one for meditation. So we've got to protect it in daily life so that it can meditate eventually. If we don't do that, our meditation will have a very hard time. So this substitution with the opposite and remembering the four supreme efforts will be the pathway towards purification, the pathway towards concentration, the pathway which opens up our spiritual life in daily living. Spiritual life does not happen in a temple. This is only an outward manifestation. Spiritual life does not happen on a little pillow. That's only one of the means. Spiritual life happens in our heart and mind. The Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, the truth, comes to life only when we ourselves manifest it. So as you start your meditation, and I will talk about the meditation itself in a moment, remember the labeling. Now that only applies when there are distracting thoughts. There are three kinds of concentration: Kanika Samadhi, Upachara Samadhi, and Apana Samadhi. Momentary concentration, neighborhood concentration, and full concentration. Mind you, the Buddha never talked about momentary or neighborhood. It's in the commentaries. But we all get it. So we'll have a look and see what that means. Momentary concentration everybody gets. For just a moment, you can stay on the breath. Now, if you have momentary concentration, that means that one moment you're on the breath and the next moment there's a thought. Label. Get to know your mind pattern. Get the habit of understanding what goes on in your own mind, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, content of mind. Realize that all of the thoughts are totally unnecessary because, in meditation, because they are connected to the world outside. And the world outside at this point in time is of no interest whatsoever. It goes on without us beautifully. Nobody is crying because we're not there. They can continue without us. We'll go back and do something when we're finished here, but we don't have to think about it. So you will recognize, if you label, that the thoughts are all connected with the world. And yet, meditation is supposed to eventually take one to transcend the world. The world is connected with all the things that we have and own, that we like and dislike. There's no need to think about that. If you have Upachara Samadhi, which means that you have been meditating in the past, nobody gets it right off. It is a feeling as if there are thoughts and attention on the breath simultaneously. They're not. The Buddha said the mind can have 3,000 mind moments in the blink of an eyelid. Luckily, we don't have that many usually, but that's how fast the mind is. So what we actually happens in neighborhood concentration, access concentration, is a back and forth between attention on the breath and the thought. And the thoughts are nebulous in neighborhood concentration. And one sometimes has a feeling as if they were going sort of in back of the head, as if they're going along here like clouds. There's no need to label, because they're not distinct enough to be labeling, to have a label. They don't have content. They're just a disturbance, that's all. If that kind of concentration happens to you, and since I don't know you, I don't know whether any of you have meditated long enough to have Upachara Samadhi, but I should think there would be some here. Samadhi means concentration, and Upachara, neighborhood. Then what is needed is a little extra determination. A little extra willpower to actually become one with the breath. To let the mind and the breath be together without any extraneous happenings, without any thinking, without anything that could take us away from being here. You see, in reality, what we're learning is to be here now. All that's happening is that we're sitting here and breathing. Everything else is conjecture. That isn't happening. What we are thinking about is all conjecture. If we were here now, we'd be with the one breath. And we can only be with the breath that is happening now. We can't be with the breath that's already gone, that's already finished, and we can't be with the breath that's going to come. We can only be with the one that is now. So that also teaches us something about ourselves, that we don't live in the moment, we don't live in the present. We're constantly concerned with what we can conjure up, past or future. So at the moment when the mind has this excess concentration, where there's thoughts in the background which are nebulous, and the attention on the breath is still there, extra determination to be there with that breath. So that full concentration can happen. Apana samadhi, full concentration. When full concentration happens, it needs to be carried on for a while. We don't get any results from it immediately. We have to have that full concentration for a little while. And when we have full concentration for a little while, we will notice a change in the breath. And that's why the breath is a traditional method and the most used method for meditation, because breath and mind are irretrievably connected. When we're excited or in a hurry, the breath goes fast and heavy. And if we're very calm and collected, the breath becomes finer and finer. So when there is apana samadhi, full concentration, for a little while, the breath becomes finer and finer. In fact, it can become so fine that we can't find it. And the mistake most people make then, unless they've been instructed otherwise, is that they take a deep breath so that they can find it again. But I would like to say at this point, before we even start, that the method which we're using, which is going to be the breath, is nothing but a key. And we need to hang on to the key, have it in hand, long enough and steady enough to stick it in the keyhole and open the door. If that is happening, that we're sticking it into the keyhole, we don't want to fiddle with the key again. We don't want to go back to the breath. We want to open the door. So if it happens that the breath becomes very fine, and possibly so fine that we can't find it, then we switch our attention from the breath, we let it drop, and switch our attention to our inner feeling. At that time, if there is proper concentration, the inner sensation is one of delightful sensations. Delightful sensation means that it is physical. If that happens, that's our next meditation subject. Again, any meditation method is just a method. It doesn't matter which one we use. Whichever one works, that's the one we use. Traditionally, we use the breath, so we'll use that here. If you have had results, good results, with any other method, to become fully concentrated, use it. A method is a method by any name. It doesn't change its character. It's only a key. Watching the breath is not yet the meditation. It's a method of getting there. And therefore, it's quite unnecessary to debate about methods, which people also like to do at times, the debate about methods. The one that works, that's the one to use. Now, watching the breath can be done in different ways. The main aspect is always the breath. But since our minds are mostly unruly and not trained enough yet, we do need crutches. And the crutches are of different kinds. If any of you can come to full concentration without any of the crutches, please do so. But if you're still being hampered and bothered by thinking, then please use one of the crutches. And I will outline 5 different crutches, and you pick one and stick to it. And if after the meditation period you feel that this particular crutch wasn't helpful and you want to meditate on your own, well, try one of the others. The first possibility is counting. One on the in-breath, one on the out-breath. 2 on the in-breath, 2 on the out-breath. No more than 10. Every time there is a distracting thought and you have labeled it and gone back to the breath, you go back to 1. Otherwise, you're going to start considering, was I at 4? I must have been at 9. And then the mind gets a new topic to think about. Just back to 1. Nobody knows about it anyway. It doesn't matter. It's just a number. If you don't like numbers and prefer words, use a word which is the crutch to stay with the breath. For instance, Buddha. Buddha on the in-breath, ho on the out-breath. It means to the Buddha. And if that's meaningful to you, it can be helpful. It means I'm dedicating my breath to the Buddha. It can be helpful for those who have devotion. If you don't like that one, choose another one. You can take, for instance, the word peace. Peace on the in-breath, peace on the out-breath. If you know a better word, use it. Words are words, by any name. If you don't like words or numbers, but you are able to visualize well, and some people are able to visualize very well, it's a knack some people have and some haven't, imagine that the breath is coming into your nose like an ocean wave. Visualize an ocean wave, maybe bright blue with silver foam on top. As it comes in, it brings the breath in. As it goes out, it takes the breath out. This is rhythmic and can be enormously helpful to gain full concentration. If you're a person that visualizes well. If you don't like that one, you can use sensation. There is a sensation at the nostrils when the in-breath touches the nostrils. There's a sensation in the nose, in the forehead, sometimes in the throat and in the lungs. Don't look for the sensation. Become aware of the sensations that you can easily recognize as they happen when the breath comes in and when the breath goes out. If you do that, stay near to yourself with the breath. Don't try to fathom what happens when it goes further. Meditation happens within. It has nothing to do with the world outside of us. So you stay as near to yourself as possible. And if you have practiced already and have gained a certain amount of mindfulness, then it can be very helpful to become aware of beginning, middle, end of the breath. You can't say those words, they're too long. The breath goes too fast. But you can use 1, 2, 3 or just becoming aware of the beginning, middle, end, again, beginning, middle, end. This is more difficult, requires more mindfulness, can be helpful to those who have already practiced but haven't gained full concentration. If you're wondering whether you ever have gained full concentration or not, don't wonder. You'll know. When you gain full concentration, there is a happening within which is totally different from what happens usually. There's nothing to wonder about. As long as we're not fully concentrated, we feel ourselves in the same way as we feel ourselves now. Well, the body is fairly heavy, and we can feel all the limbs, and we know exactly where we're sitting. When full concentration happens, the whole body feeling changes. So there's nothing to wonder or worry about. When it happens, you'll know. In order to gain full concentration, we need to let go. Letting go is the key word for spiritual practice, not just for meditation. And I'd like to mention, make you aware with emphasis, that meditation is only one part of spiritual practice. It isn't the whole of it. On the other hand, without it, spiritual practice does not get off the ground. It belongs in there. Letting go is a key word. We've got to let go of extraneous thinking. And why is that so difficult? Because we have no other ego support system when we're not talking to anybody except our own thinking. Nobody can tell us we're here unless we're thinking. And because we are not very keen on letting go of our ego support system, it's very difficult to let go of thinking. So any of you who are new at this, or those of you who have done it and are thinking during meditation, don't be surprised. The difficulty lies in the fact that when there's no thought, there's also nobody there to tell us that this is me. But when you do let go of the thinking and have nobody telling you that this is me, you will find that that's the only way to become peaceful. And you will realize they have an inkling, a sample of what the Buddha is actually teaching. It's a bit of a beginning of letting go of our totally ego-centered thought processes. So the difficulty in meditation is the same as the difficulty in daily life. There's no difference between our ego-centered daily living or our ego-centered meditation. The more we let go, the easier everything becomes. My new book, which is in German, so you won't be able to read it, the title is, Without Me, Life is Quite Easy. And if you ever get full concentration in meditation, and I hope you do, you will see how easy it is. But you've got to let go. And this is another key phrase that we can use to help ourselves. When the thinking becomes quite regular in the meditation, one thought after another and another and another, maybe it will be helpful to you to tell yourself, let go. It can be helpful. Now, with the five different methods I've outlined, or crutches for attending to the breath, please pick one. And as you pick one, stay with it for the next half hour, which we'll use for the meditation. And before we start, has anyone any question about what to do and how to do it? Nothing philosophical, just how to do it and what to do. Is anything unclear? No. If you haven't got full concentration as your regular meditation method, use one of the props. You will still get thoughts, and you will still be able to label, because the props do not protect you from thinking, but they will give a certain assistance to stay with the breath. So unless one has already gained full concentration and has already been able to let go of the breath as a meditation subject, use one of the props. But don't do the labeling if you have this kind of feeling as if the thoughts are in the background of the head, they're nebulous, and the breath attention is still there. If that is happening, if the thoughts are nebulous and the attention on the breath is still there, there's no need to label, there's only the need to have more determination. Have more determination to stay with the breath. Is that clear? Okay. Anything else? I will stand up a moment and stretch our legs and then sit down for the meditation. Give you a more detailed exposition on how the purification of the mind works through our meditative practice. I've already said that the concentration helps us. I've explained how the labeling helps us, how we can do that in daily living then, so that we can continue with the four supreme efforts. But there's more to it than that. We're often inclined to blame others for our own reactions. In fact, most of the time, most people do that. It's just human nature. And actually, what others do has very little to do with our reactions. They're just triggers. I like to compare that with a jack-in-the-box, a little toy that children have, a little box, a little doll inside sitting on a spring, and it's got a lid on. And if the child touches the lid, little jack-in-the-box jumps out. Now, if somebody comes along and tears the little doll out of the box, throws it away, the child can come with a hammer and hit the lid, and nothing jumps out. The little jack-in-the-box sits in here. And some people we only need to touch lightly and it jumps out. And some we have to touch a little harder and it jumps out. But as long as there's little jack-in-the-box inside, it will jump out. If somebody says something we don't like, we react. If we see something that we think is ugly or awful, we react. If we taste or touch something, we react. So the reaction is not the fault of the trigger. And the formula for that is, don't blame the trigger. And since the world, as we know it, this little globe of ours, consists of about 6 billion unenlightened people, we have 6 billion people with all having 5 hindrances. And should we ever wonder why the world is the way it is, we should not any longer be surprised. That's just the way it is. But each one of us that purifies contributes to the purification of the world, because we are the world. It's not out there, somebody else. It's us. So each single person that attains some purity is a great boon to mankind and can make a difference to their environment. The first thing that happens in meditation, in any meditation, whether you get concentrated or not, is that you have an initial application of the mind to the meditation subject, which means you put your mind on the breath or on the walking. Now that's the initial thing that happens in meditation. This initial application is the first factor of meditation. Happens in any meditation that we do. And it is the counteraction against the hindrance of sloth and torpor, laziness and drowsiness. Now you have maybe experienced becoming drowsy in meditation. Put your mind on the meditation subject again, and you've counteracted that drowsiness. But the laziness and drowsiness or sloth and torpor of the mind is more than what happens in meditation. It's the mind that says, ah, I can't be bothered. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it when it's cooler. I'll do it when I have more time. Why should I do it? Nobody else does it. And so on and so forth. There's a whole gamut of excuses, and all of us have used them, and we all know them. And they're the justifications. And I don't feel like it, and I don't feel good enough, and so on. The mind, which has that laziness and drowsiness, is of course the cause for the body then to become just as lazy and drowsy. The Buddha compared that to being in prison, a prison of our own making, where we actually have the key. If our mind says, I can't be bothered, let somebody else do it, which is very common, or I'll do it later, I'll do it tomorrow, procrastination, and all those things are imprisoning us into just looking after the most essential aspects for staying alive. Just looking after eating and sleeping and making money, maybe the livelihood, and washing. And that's all we can do then when the mind is like that. And to try and do nothing else except survive is a waste of a precious human life. It's a foregone conclusion that none of us are going to stay alive. So why do only that? That's why the Buddha called it to be in prison, when the mind is lazy and drowsy. And every time we put the mind on the meditation subject, we counteract that. We become alert. We have to be alert in order to be on the meditation subject. We don't have any choices. Obviously, the mind can wander off again. And that too happens in meditation. Maybe we've put the mind on the meditation subject and are sitting quite comfortably. And then the mind starts to drift. It's quite comfortable. It's quite pleasant. We're not asleep, but we're also not awake. We're drifting. It happens to most meditators at one time or another, especially in hot weather. Careful, it can become a habit. Meditation is not letting the mind drift. We can do that in the bathtub. Meditation is being totally alert, awake, and aware. Awake and aware, in this case, of the meditation subject, of the method, of the breath. Now, we have this automatic helpmate in the meditation. But again, in daily living, we need mindfulness. Paying attention to ourselves in order to counteract the laziness and the drowsiness of the mind. When the mind becomes really lazy, it's also an escape mechanism. We don't really want to know everything that's going on. We can't escape. We're here for the duration. We might as well know what's going on with ourselves. So this is the very first factor of meditation, counteracting one of the hindrances, and needs to be seen for what it is so that we can continue it in daily living. The second factor of meditation comes about when the concentration starts. Then we don't have to constantly redo our initial application. Every time we think, we have to start again with our initial application on the meditation subject. But when the concentration has begun, then comes a second factor, continued application to the meditation subject. In Pali, that's vitakka and vichara, often wrongly translated. Now, the second one, the continued application to the meditation subject, brings about a very important shift in one's whole attitude towards meditation. It counteracts skeptical doubt. Skeptical doubt is a human faculty which everybody has to some degree and only disappears completely regarding the spiritual path when we have already gained the stream entry. So that's a ways away. But we need to counteract skeptical doubt, because otherwise the mind says, I'll meditate when I have time. And that's the most common one. Nobody ever has time. There's always something else that can be done. And most people find something else to do. The world is full of stuff we can do. Well, of course, there are other justifications. I'll meditate when the children are bigger. I'll meditate when it's cooler or hotter. I'll meditate when my boss is away and doesn't bother me so much. Whatever it is. But it is basically, I'll meditate when I have time. The skeptical doubt which underlies that is the fact that nothing has happened in meditation. It hasn't brought any result that one knows, and one can't see that it is essential. It's life-preserving. It's a quality of life-preserving. One can't see it because it isn't obvious. And the skeptical doubt goes further than that. It says, well, maybe I can do it. Don't have to really meditate, do I? I mean, I could do Tai Chi, couldn't I? Just as well. I don't have to sit still doing that. Or yoga might be the answer. And so one looks around for this and that. The Buddha compared that with a trip in the desert without any provisions and without a road map, going around in circles in the desert and in the end being overrun by bandits. The desert is one's own mind. We believe our own mind until we have meditated long enough to realize that it throws up anything it wants to. We do call the mind a magician. It can do anything, anything at all. And when we stop believing it, then we do not search around so much anymore. But in the beginning, this skeptical doubt is directed towards the meditation itself and towards one's own ability to do it. Another thought is, it's too difficult, I'll never learn it. I bet nobody can stay on the breath. That's also a very often heard sentiment. How can anybody do that? They must all be geniuses if they can do that. It also has that skeptical doubt, that doubting quality, where we're not even quite sure what it means to have a spiritual path. Is it really necessary? I mean, the main thing is to make a living, isn't it, and to be a decent person. Well, obviously, yes, we do have to be a decent person and have to make a living. But then comes this doubt, is it really necessary to sit there and the back starts aching and the knees start aching and what is this all for? This doubting quality makes us less able to meditate because it takes all the strength out of the mind. And it totally undermines one of the factors which is essential for meditation and essential for spiritual life, and that's trust and confidence. Sadda. Now, sadda is not faith, because the word faith in English is loaded. It's loaded with the understanding that faith is blind faith. And we do say blind faith can move mountains. But unfortunately, being blind doesn't know which mountain needs moving. So the Buddha was totally against that. He spoke of confidence, but not of faith. Trust. Like a child has trust in the mother, that if it takes the hand of the mother, that the mother will take it across a busy intersection without any mishap. It doesn't question the mother, can you do it? Will you take me across? Are you going to save me from the cars? It just takes a hand and goes across. Now that kind of confidence in the Buddha's teaching is necessary to try out all the guidelines. The Buddha did not want us to believe anything. He was totally against that, because in his kind of society and culture, that was a great mishap. People believing what they were told by the priests. So he didn't want that. But what is needed is enough confidence to try it all out, and to try it out long enough to really become well imbued with it, not just to give it a try one afternoon. When we gain that kind of feeling towards the Buddha and his teaching, the meditative practice, and our own ability, there is strength in the mind. Confidence means also self-confidence. It doesn't mean that we think we're more or better or bigger than others. It just means that we have a feeling of the necessary ability within us to grow. The spiritual path is inner growth. So we have confidence that we can do that. That confidence is enormously important on the path. Because essentially, we have to all do it ourselves. Sure, there are teachers, but what can they do? They can only talk about it, interpret the Buddha's teachings, give guidelines according to the Buddha's teaching, but they can't do it, only for themselves. So every person has to do it for him or herself. When the continued application to the meditation subject happens on the breath, that's when that confidence arises. The mind says, oh, I can do it after all. It is possible to stay on the breath. I didn't think so, but it is. Buddha must have known what he talked about. Feels quite peaceful. Now, of course, all this rummaging in the mind has taken one off the breath already, but at least it has voiced that confidence. The doubting quality in oneself is very often also a kind of assertion of oneself. I really know already. I don't want to be told. That's a very common feeling. And if one feels that, one doubts what one is told, of course, instead of trying it out. Now, with the Buddha's teaching, we also have to take into consideration that it is a whole totality of teaching, touching the human being in all its facets and not just meditation. So if we gain confidence, we need to also look into all the other aspects of the teaching. A teaching consists of three parts: sila, samadhi and panya. Sila is moral conduct, samadhi is what we're trying to do here, get concentrated, and panya is insight, wisdom, which is what is supposed to arise out of the concentration. And those three parts are the three parts of the whole. And we can't pick one out and say, well, I'll take the meditation, but I'll leave the rest go. It doesn't work. So when we are coming to that point where the mind stays with the breath, we have that help that underwrites our strength of mind, says, I can do it, it is all right, it works, and we will do it again. There's still no guarantee that we will do it again, but at least we have realized that meditation brings us to states of mind which can be very peaceful, at least that much. Now, that also has to be continued outside of meditation in our daily lives through getting to know more about the teaching. Both of these hindrances, the sloth and torpor of the mind and the skeptical doubt, have as their counter work in daily life, knowing more about the teaching. So one then, having gained confidence, one does automatically try to find out what else did the Buddha say. And he talked about practically, one should say, everything that concerns human life. Now, having got this far in the meditation, something very important happens. There's a total change over. If we get that far, we can stay on the meditation subject. There comes the moment when the changeover happens. A changeover means that, as I indicated earlier, the breath becomes very fine. It can become so fine that we can't find it. At that time, we let go of the breath. because, as I said, it is only the key. And we go inside of ourselves with our attention and become aware of delightful sensation. Pali, piti. Not the English piti, but piti, P-I-T-I. Now, that word is sometimes translated as rapture, but it is too strong a word. I would say that delightful sensation is a strong enough description of it. In the traditional explanations, we can find 17 different ways of having this delightful sensation. The most common ones are feeling very light in the body, a prickling sensation, a tingling sensation, warmth, not heat, but warmth, usually emanating from the spiritual heart region, a feeling sometimes as if one is floating. In other words, the body sensation changes. It doesn't have the heaviness that we are experiencing now. Right now, we experience not only the heaviness, but also the outer borders of the body. We know exactly how far we go. Well, that all that becomes diffuse. And because of this, it's delightful. It's delightful and other. And of course, when it happens the first time, the mind says, "Ooh, what's that?" And that's the end of that meditation. And then we start all over again. And the next time the mind says, "Oh, that's very nice, I have to get that back." Well, that's the end of that one. And doesn't work. It's useless to try to get anything. On the spiritual path and in meditation, it's totally useless to try to get anything. The only thing that's useful on the spiritual path and in meditation is to give oneself away. And the more we give ourselves away, the easier everything becomes. So what we do in meditation, we give our thinking away. We give our ego concern away. We give away the concern we have about all the things that have happened or are going to happen. We give all that away. We don't want to get. It is important to know what will happen in meditation. But on the other hand, it is counterproductive to want it to happen. We have to have the concentration where it will happen automatically. Meditation is science of mind. And because it's a science of mind, it happens to everybody in the same way. It is repeatable. It's explainable. And that's what the Buddha did. He explained it. And it has the same pathway for everyone. In the beginning, we watch the breath and think. Eventually, we can stop. As we stop thinking, we put that key in the keyhole and open the door. And the door opens to our inner being, which I like to compare to 8 chambers. Most people don't know that there is such a door. It is covered over with debris. We can't see it. It's not a real door, of course. The debris are our thoughts and our emotions. As long as they're in the way, the door is invisible. The minute we stop emoting and reacting and thinking, we can get near it and open it and cross over that threshold into the first chamber. crossing over into that very first chamber, which is first jhana, first meditative absorption, provides a home for the mind. Now, I like to compare that to the home we all have for the body. We all have a home for the body. And what do we find in that home? We have a kitchen so that we can eat. We have an easy chair so we can sit comfortably. We have bed to sleep in, bathroom to wash ourselves in, dining room to eat. Everything is there for the body. And if we are out working during the day, we know we can go back to that and have a roof over our head and be protected from the unpleasantness of heat and cold and rain and storms. But what does the mind do while the body is comfortable in its easy chair? It usually goes over all the happenings of the day, or it makes plans for the next day, or it worries about the future, or it regrets the past, or it's angry at oneself that one hasn't reacted in the right way. It's got all sorts of things it's doing. It hasn't got any easy chair. It's just busy. And the same happens, of course, when we go on holiday. The body is very comfortable. And what does the mind do? It dissects all the other people who are on holiday in the same place. It tries to figure out what's wrong with them. Or whatever the mind likes to do. When we are able to get to this very first step in meditation, and this is where meditation starts, before that it's method, which we need. We need method to get there. But once having gone past the method of the breath and having got to that very first step of meditation and having found this home for the mind, then the mind knows the minute we sit down for meditation, we can have that home again. We can have comfort for the mind. It's the only and first time that the mind will have utter and complete comfort. Of course, the other chambers will be even more comfortable, but we don't know that yet. We're in the first one. And it's a totally different ambience for the mind to anything that we have experienced until then. So even though we can only do that in the meditation, and the meditation is time limited, it still has a residual effect in our daily life. Because just as we know that we can go home to our house or our apartment and have a roof over our heads and have all the comforts for the body, and by the same token we know that we can go home and sit down and have the comfort for the mind. And what happens because of that is that all the difficulties that one encounters in daily living, or the confrontations one has with other people, that they still happen, but they don't touch one quite as strongly as they used to. It is as if one had a cushion around one's emotions. Now, obviously, when one could pierce cushions too, and they do get pierced, but at least it's a protection. One knows, basically one knows, that there is another dimension. One is not totally dependent upon what other people do and say. One isn't totally dependent upon what oneself knows and can do. One isn't totally dependent upon all the worldly aspects. One has found part of one's inner wealth. That inner wealth is immeasurably greater than any outer wealth we could ever accumulate. And it is the inner wealth that cannot be stolen or corrupted by rust or moth, which is from the Sermon on the Mount. It is that which we carry within. All of us have it. Everyone has it. We just need to get at it. And the only way to get at it is through meditation. The first time it happens, it feels like a peak experience, which it actually isn't, because there are many other experiences in meditation which can come after. And it has that quality of total penetration of the whole person, the experience, because it's quite strong. And we may even have had some experiences like that in our daily lives, like, for instance, having seen a very beautiful sunset and becoming quite identified with it, and really having that inner experience of lightness and enjoyment, and then thinking that it's due to the sunset. It's not. The sunset was the trigger. It was due to total concentration on that particular beautiful aspect. And it's no use going looking for sunset, because next time we mightn't be concentrated. But if we are only dependent upon our own concentration in order to gain that inner experience, we have gained a great benefit, because we no longer depend upon only our sense contacts. The interesting aspect of it is that our pleasant sense contacts become more pleasant. And people that have attended meditation courses and meditated well sometimes experience the fact that when they go outside after some days of meditation, the grass looks greener and the sky looks bluer. Well, it doesn't. It's just that their senses are purer. And that purification comes about because, having gained access to one's inner wealth, one doesn't constantly look for the outer happening, and not looking for it and not trying to get it and not trying to keep it makes the experience then pure. It's just the experience. It's just the green grass or the blue sky. And because it is pure, it has far more density in it. It is far easier to see the beauty in it. We don't want to get it back. We are not looking for it. So our sense experiences become more satisfying because we're not looking for them. We don't have to look for them because we have found something else. We have found the inner experience, which is only dependent upon our concentration. That's all it's dependent upon. This particular aspect, the third factor of meditation, piti, counteracts ill will. Now that's quite a hindrance, as everybody knows. The Buddha compared ill will to a bilious disease, the bile coming up. But for the one who's angry, of course. He also compared anger to picking up hot coals with one's bare hands and trying to throw them at somebody. Who gets burned first? Obviously the one who's picking up the hot coals. And then we might even try to throw them at somebody who has practiced long enough to know how to duck. And the whole thing is totally useless. We are angry, and we are suffering from that anger. This comparison of a bilious disease means that when we get angry and have ill will, we feel sick. We don't feel well. Now, obviously, this delightful sensation that we experience in the meditation counteracts this during the meditation, which is, again, time-limited. But, as I said before, there's a residual effect. We feel cushioned. And this residual effect is something which carries on the purification. The less angry we get, the easier it is to purify. The less we react to the things we don't like, the more stable our mind becomes. The stability of mind is the final resultant of calm and insight. A stable mind no longer has to worry or has to hope or has to do anything. It's contented with the moment. This works in that direction. Anger was also compared by the Buddha to a pond of water where the wind was going and the waves are going high. Now this is a very apt comparison, because when our emotions go high, it's like being in an ocean, under an ocean wave, and seeing nothing but the water. First, that has to subside again, and the ocean has to, or the pond, has to become calm again before we can look into the depth of it. When we can look into the depth of it, we can see what's at the bottom. We can see sand and coral and fish and whatever's at the bottom. The same within us. As long as we have anger and emotions arising, there is so much turmoil that all we see are the emotions. When everything subsides and there's stability of mind, there's calmness of mind, when that subsides, that's when we can see into depth. As we see into depth, we become aware of a different reality. We say that we live in a relative reality. There is an absolute reality. The relative reality tells us that we are a separate person. It tells us that there's a me and a you, and it tells us that there are some things we like and others we don't like, and that we have to get some things and have to get rid of others. In that relative reality, all that the world provides seems true. In the absolute reality, none of that has any bearing on anything. In the absolute reality, there's anicca, dukkha, anatta, which means impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and substancelessness. As we get the meditation to that point where we realize that we do not have to depend upon outer conditions for our happiness, we have taken an enormous step, because we have freed ourselves from total dependence upon our senses. The Buddha teaches liberation, freedom. This is the first step of freedom, not to be dependent upon our sense contact. We get them, but we don't have to depend on them. We have something within us which is not only independent of that, only dependent upon concentration, but it is also of a more penetrating quality. The first four absorptions are called the fine material absorptions, the rupa jhanas. And they are called that because we can have similar situations in the normal state. Similar, caused by outer triggers, dependent upon an outer trigger, as I was explaining about the sunset, and not of the same quality, but similar. There are then four more, which are the immaterial absorptions, the arupa jhanas. And they are states of consciousness which we have nothing to compare with. They do not exist in our ordinary daily lives. Delightful sensations do exist based on outer trigger and not of the same quality. But these other four have nothing to compare with. What it all amounts to is, first of all, the purification aspect. Secondly, the widening, the expansion of consciousness. As long as our consciousness has nothing else to relate to except that what happens day to day, we're very limited. It's really not satisfying at all. But when the meditation comes to this point of the first jhana, the consciousness starts expanding and realizing that there's something other. Obviously, that goes on with a greater impact as we use the other jhanas. There's one other factor, well, actually there are two more meditative factors and two more hindrances, and I'll quickly delineate them. There's one more factor of the meditation which also exists in all meditations, whether they are of a second duration or whether one actually does become concentrated, and that's one-pointedness. The mind becomes one-pointed towards a meditation subject. Now, having practiced, one becomes one-pointed towards the breath, and then having gone to the first absorption, to the delightful sensation, one is one-pointed on that. So whatever we do in meditation, just as initial application is part and parcel of every meditation and counteracts sloth and torpor, so is one-pointedness part and parcel of any meditation, whether it's short or long or has any real concentration in it or not. This one-pointedness counteracts our sensual desire. Now, the Buddha compared sensual desire, the desire for sensual gratification, compared that to being in debt. We have to constantly use our senses and are indebted to them for our happiness. And in fact, we have to pay interest, because what was satisfying one moment is no longer satisfying the next. This indebtedness is totally counteracted by our one-pointedness in meditation. When we are one-pointed, nothing else can enter. That's it. Just the one-pointedness, in this case of the delightful sensation. Now, sensual desire was also compared by the Buddha to a water pond into which many colors had been thrown. And when one throws many colors into a water pond, one can't see one's likeness anymore. Just as one can't see one's likeness when there is wind in the water pond and the waves go high. When we really desire something, we can't think straight. All we want is that thing. And unfortunately, sensual desire has the quality of a promise that we're going to become happy when we get what we want. Ill will does not have the promise of being happy. Ill will promises to be unhappy. And that's why it's often said that those people who have more ill will than they have desire are the better practitioners. They have more dukkha, so they practice better. The desire always has that hope in the background that getting that particular thing, I'm going to be really happy. That it doesn't pan out that way, is then nothing but a beginning.